Hello everyone. Today I'm talking to Andy Pullane, who helps designers move from a executive or delivery-based team role into leadership and what it takes and what to consider and what to know about business and what to know about teams and to manage them for designers. So it will be an interesting conversation about people who transition from one particular role into another or want to understand more about what it takes to be a design leader. Hope you enjoy.
Before the interview, a quick word from our very first sponsor, Zencastr. We use Zencastr for all our audio and video recording, and it's a very nifty tool that splits up all the channels for very easy editing. Zencastr is used by 10% of all active podcasts. You can get 40% off the first 3 months and unlimited audio and video recordings with our special coupon code WICKEDPODCAST. I repeat, Wicked Podcast for 40% off. And now the interview.
Hello, everyone. Today we're here with Andy Pullane. Hello, Andy, and thank you for being with us.
Thanks. Thanks for the invite.
And as usual, we're starting at the top. So please tell our listeners who you are and what you do.
So my name's Andy Pullane. I primarily now am a design leadership coach. So I coach design leaders from kind of lead level to up to kind of VP or beyond. There's no CDOs that I in my roster of clients at the moment because not that many CDOs. And then I also teach service design mostly to masters of design students or masters of service design students. And I sometimes teach and train clients. And I write a newsletter and podcast too. That's the short version.
Podcast. There we go. Yes. Now we're doing with the short, and then we're diving a bit more into a couple of things, as usual. So design. So what sort of the struggles and interests or parts of the job that you find people are most interested in to learn more about or for you to help them through?
So I've sort of got a bit of a niche in the sense that there is a thing that I call the design leadership dip. It goes beyond design. Definitely. And, you know, I know people from engineering, I know people from, you know, from different parts of product, but also from things like, you know, medicine and stuff. No, I don't coach those people, but they go through a similar thing. And the dip is when you've created an identity making things normally. So as a designer, that's my sort of niche. And then when you get moving into a sort of design leadership role, so at the beginning, that's often like leading a project, then it might be leading a team sort of more permanently. And then it might be being, you know, responsible for a function or, you know, becoming a sort of head of maybe a certain part of product or whatever it is or service design. And then, you know, further on to departments and regions and so forth. There's a thing that happens, which is necessarily you have to give up some of the doing. And if your identity, your identity is very much bound up in the fact that you make stuff for a living. And as you start to give that up, you start to realize that sort of everything you're doing is all about people, right? Now, it was a real realization for me was this moment of like, oh, this, my job is not really about sort of directing designers, you know, as a design director or regional design director, because kind of experienced designers and even like fairly, you know, someone who's got a few years under their belt, they generally don't have that much in the way of sort of design problems. They're not sitting there going, oh, Andy, you know, I don't know how to design this. It's all people stuff. This stakeholder's a pain. We're having arguments amongst the team about, you know, what method we should be doing. And this person says personas are like this, and I think they're like that. And the client is this. All of that stuff is, a massive amount of what you're doing, plus trying to convince stakeholders usually about the, you know, what's the value of design and so forth. And that's not stuff you get taught in design school. It's also stuff, unless you've been lucky to have good role models and good people above you, it's kind of stuff you don't really learn quite often at all until you get told to do it. And so for some people, it's a real step change. For other people, it's more gradual, where they are suddenly like, oh, now I'm responsible for people, and I'm responsible for people's development. I'm responsible for the outcomes of this or whatever. and they struggle, right? Because that's the dip. So you sort of start to let go of the tools, and that sort of gets a bit worse. And then if I'm drawing a little sort of graph with my finger, and then you're at the beginning of a different journey. And in that dip, Well, the moment you're in that dip is actually meant to be the time when you're sort of at the top of your game, particularly if you're a head of or something, or a design director, a director of. You're supposed to be the sort of, you know, the top of your game. And quite often you might be the most senior design person in your organization, particularly if you're working in-house somewhere. And so it's a bit of an existential crisis because, you know, you're supposed to know what you're doing. You really don't feel like you do. And yet it's very lonely at the top. And so you don't have anyone to talk through and talk this stuff through. And that's what my coaching is mostly about, is helping people navigate this. And I think the extra bit of that is, for a lot of people, that mid-career moment comes also in sort of midlife moment. So a lot of my coaches, and not all, some of them are in their 20s, some of them are over 50, like me. But a lot of them are in their sort of mid to late 30s to late 40s, and it happens at a moment in life when they're also really questioning everything they're doing. So that's what I coach them through.
Oh, everything at once then. So you talked a fair bit about shifting, you know, from your tools to people. And you mentioned sort of the teams that people manage and so on. Mm. And you mentioned stakeholders a little bit. And I want to dig a bit more into the stakeholder thing, because I'm personally quite interested in the whole silo thing and how organizations are structured. And I think in particular, when you go in more into a leadership level, you start talking about budgets and business value a bit more, or other costs and other relevancies, rather than just, did we a good job for this one client, right? What's sort of the aspect there when, what do you see, how far people sort of have to get in contact with other peers, you know, on the same, let's say, head of level or director level? So, because I think at that level, sometimes you need to collaborate. I mean, depending on your organization, that's why I'm asking sort of what they're discovering there. What stories do you hear there?
Yeah, so that collaboration is obviously essential, really, if you're going to get anything done. And sort of I come from, actually I studied film, and maybe we talked about it before, so I wanted to be a film director. But at the time I was studying it, this new thing called digital media started. So that's how I got into interactive media in the very early 90s. And, you know, we've been working in digital of one way or another ever since. And so, you know, one of the things that you really have to do a lot of is shift out of talking about design and start talking about, you don't have to necessarily talk about business. I think this is perhaps a struggle or a mistake. I think it's useful for design folks, senior design folks, to understand, you know, how businesses operate and kind of what's important. But I think it's also a mistake when designers feel like they need to sort of jettison their design identity as a senior or, you know, leadership designer, and sort of become what we would pejoratively call a suit, right? And just become a sort of numbers person and that stuff.
Yeah.
Because then, you know, why are you there, right? You're just probably a sort of substandard MBA. So why do it, right? And you might want to just go off and do an MBA. I think that, you know, you bring a unique lens through the patterns that you see, through your mindset, you know, the patterns you've seen in the past and your kind of philosophy that you bring to that. And I think that's a really important thing to bring to that table in leadership in an organization. The shift in vocabulary, though, is there's this kind of rude awakening, I think, where people get into that sort of VP, senior leadership, kind of VP C-suite level, which is to discover that sort of they don't care about design, really. You know, I mean, it's fairly rare. In terms of what I mean by that is all the process and all the kind of, you know, polish and all the stuff that you've been used to talking about for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And suddenly kind of they don't care. What they do care about is impact and outcomes for the organization. At least that's what they should be caring about. And that's perhaps a different struggle. So sort of shifting what you're talking about, not about, you know, we really need to do more human-centered design because customers really need to be at the center and we really need to do research. Yeah. That stuff's sort of entirely boring. Oh, not entirely boring. It's not important to, you know, the C-suite. What does matter is, this is risky if we do this and we just kind of make loads of assumptions and we, you know, try and plan this all out a year in advance. We're going to end up wasting time and resources. And by doing that, we will have then spent those time and resources on things that we could have spent on something else and other opportunities, or we're missing opportunities. And all those kinds of things matter. And it kind of takes a while, I think, to get out of the habit. And the part of the struggle is when you're at a kind of head of level or something, is you're kind of having still to speak both, right? You're having to, you know, Peter Mehrholz talks about this, of sort of splitting your attention to you know, you're having those kinds of conversations with senior leadership and stakeholders. At the same time, you need to sort of revert back to talking about design and how to achieve those outcomes to design people.
So I think we're talking about it at a quite interesting time when we're here in the UK and I think globally to some extent. Mm. But I think in particular here we see now that a lot of companies have been shifting, either sometimes outsourcing or cutting or redistributing their design capabilities. Mm. So sometimes from centralized to decentralized, sometimes outsourced and sometimes even getting rid of a lot of people. So do you think that the shift of narrative, because you described it in some sense, you know, when I obviously think about human-centered design, just as the way you do, we're biased, we know what the value is, and the value for the customer is essentially translate as a value to the business, because even sort of business, I think, should know this, without a customer, you don't have a business, right? However, we all know that the business is often biased towards itself and say, well, no, but we need to really talk in terms of what the business value is and how we can de-risk our investment. Is it just that shift that needs to happen so that designers need to talk a bit less about it's good for the customer, which sounds odd because a lot of companies put that on their label and on their brands, like we're customer-centric, care about the customer, but we don't often know that the reality is a bit different. Is it just that shift of narrative, or is there a bit more to it in terms of what a designer can bring at, at that senior level to the rest of the leadership?
So, you know, we talked about collaboration before and the, mm-hmm. I said, you know, it's up to designers, you know, I don't think designers should sort of jettison their designerliness. So when they bring that to that conversation with whoever that is, you know, if it's with head of engineering or head of, you know, business or head of product or any of those people, you know, the whole point is that diverse set of viewpoints to try and sort of work out fairly kind of fundamental stuff of, you know, what's the opportunity here? What should we be building or creating? Is there a need for this? If we're not sure, how do we find out? I mean, none of that stuff really changes. It's kind of fairly simple in a way. It just gets really fouled up by a lot of kind of processes and kind of traditioning in organizations. But, you know, effectively, So someone once asked me why do companies exist, and I thought it was a really good question, and I thought about it for a bit. And my definition of it is companies exist to serve the needs of people, and so, you know, what you get going on is obviously differing needs, right? So to serve the needs of their customers ultimately, without whom they don't exist. But also, a company exists because it's a vehicle for a group of people to work together on something better than if they try to do it on their own. And of course, for investors, it's a way of them making money, right? So they've got these kind of competing needs going on. And I think that what happens just in the same way that designers can get very close to their own work and kind of get a little bit, you know, they need someone to bounce it off of, the same happens with business leadership, where they get very focused on the internals. And, you know, and chasing numbers, mostly those are made up numbers, but, you know, does this one fictional number match the other one? And really get caught in that kind of inside out kind of way. Like we, you know, that's why you get services and products that reflect the internal structure of a company instead of, you know, what people actually need to do, what their customers actually need to do. So I think one of the things that designers are very, very good at is, coming with that outside in perspective, right? Whether that is, this is the actual needs, this is how customers actually talk about what they need to be done. They don't want to fill in form 37B, they want to apply for a new passport, you know, and those kinds of things. And then really trying to bring that lens into those conversations. And there's going to be tensions, right? There's going to be tensions. It's the classic sort of trio, right? Between, you know, desirable, viable, and feasible, and that's a conversation, that's a collaboration, and then there are compromises to be made. And the most important thing, I believe, in personal life but also in those organizations, is those are intentional, right? That we say, okay, well, we're going to decide to do this over this. And, you know, that those even over statements are really, really useful for that. And you have some criteria why you're going to do that. And, you know, the actions you then take express your values as an organization, not the thing you say. You know, as you said, you say it on the tin. I'm making it sound that's the utopian view, right? And there I think design has a fantastic place to sit. But quite often it just gets crushed by we have to hit these numbers.
Yeah, it's a really interesting puzzle because, you know, and especially when I was talking to Doug Powell, but also Tom Scott, and you'll know this, you know, there's a public available business case for design, and the value of it is evidenced anywhere from certain product successes to funding successes. I think Slack got incredibly more funding, and some of the investors said, like, it just looks good. It's just it builds its intuitive aspects much better than other tools. Yeah. So design has a massive impact to actually raise more money for the company. You know, Apple, there's the Great Forrester report, you know, it all, including a report where they looked at the stock market performance of design-led companies versus others, and they outperformed them by a mile.
Yeah, I mean, one I remember reading, it might have been the DMI review one, actually, it was like 30 times or something, like, you know, yeah.
Exactly. So, and somewhere, that's hard numbers, and there's evidence, and, you know, I'm still, you know, and I'm in the weeds myself often, working in companies where the maturity level is a bit lower, and there it's even a bit harder often to get that narrative into the upper level. And even, you know, when they sort of understand that there's a place for customer experience and the design of it and all of that, or internal processes to be better designed from a human perspective, they seem to really struggle. Do you have any stories sort of where sort of any struggles people overcame? Because that's, I think, what everyone would probably like to know, you know, if this is all these challenges that designers often have when they not just level up or just amongst the C-level or something like that, you know, and the narrative doesn't land because there's another narrative there. I mean, do you know what the other narrative really is in specifics, or is there anything to overcome, or any story where you had someone that you talked to who managed to land something and broke something through, true, or maybe just took the C-level out to a workshop or a way day and just gave them a crash course in this is what design is. It's not to tell you that you don't know stuff. It's just to give you that viewpoint so you understand me better, I understand you better, and so on, right?
There are a few, and I was also, now you've just put me on the spot and trying to kind of think about what they are. I think that, I talk more generally, and maybe the specific example will come. Design's secret superpower is making an abstract idea tangible, right? Whether that's in a sketch on a post-it note, or whether it's in a storyboard or a kind of mock-up, or, you know, in service design we often do a kind of like day in the life of fictional kind of future video of like, this is, imagine this service was existing. Mm-hmm. And that's really important. And there's a book by Ken Cosiender called I think it's called Creative Selection. He's the guy who invented the iPhone keyboard. And talked about the demo culture at Apple. It amazed me, this, actually, because in it he talks about he worked with this other guy, Bass, who doing these mock-ups, these demos, rather, of the different keyboards, because I don't know if people know the story, but there was a moment in time where they just stopped all development on the iPhone because they couldn't get the keyboard right. And they were like, everything else is going to be useless if we can't get the keyboard right. No one could even type their name without it. So then they just said, we're going to spend a week or two, just every team is going to prototype keyboards. And the amazing thing was that Bass, this guy, was doing the prototypes of the keyboard in MacroMind Director, or would have been Adobe Director.
Yeah.
So it kind of, I've loved that. I was like, that's amazing.
So this makes our old hearts feel very warm, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I was like, wow. And so, you know, he talked about this demo culture, you know, at Apple, and, you know, the way it worked is you'd sort of get selected. It was like, you know, a casting show. You get kind of, your thing would get selected to go forward, and eventually Steve Jobs would kind of have it in his hand and kind of and play with it and make some, give some feedback, and then, you know, and go ahead or not. And it's incredibly powerful. Like, for non-designers, the ability to be able to sketch out an idea, you know, whether it's a storyboard or a mock-up, it's kind of like magic to people, because most people stopped being able to do that when they're about kind of 10 or 11, whenever they stopped doing art at school. Right? And I think designers take it for granted. But when you do that, and this is what Cosiender talks about, is you have an artifact, that you can talk to, right? And so the most amazing alignment thing, and this for me, and this is the whole point of things like, you know, service blueprints and journey maps and stuff. It's not that they're a means to an end, right? It's the thing itself is less relevant, but they give you everyone a thing to look at and go, okay, now I see that, I understand it, or we all understand it. You know, here's where this is wrong, or here's where I thought it was this, and here's where we're misaligned. And it's incredibly useful. So I really suggest that designers lean on that, because there are examples of that where we're working with a government department, and we were working with the clients of that government department, it was the tax office. So then we had sort of tax advisors there. And we did this workshop with them. We'd done several bits of, you know, different workshops with them before and stuff to try and get their input. And we got to the point where there were concepts. And one of the things was like, I want to have a calendar, you know, with all when my clients' tax returns are due. And so we do this thing where we'd call it a make shop, where we're kind of sketching stuff up and, you know, using something like, you know, Marvel or something to kind of photograph and those sketches and make them a little bit interactive. And it was this sort of amazing moment where they were like, oh, now I see that. That's not what I want at all, because I've got loads of calendars. And what I really want is a, you know, prioritized list on my dashboard. So there's kind of lots of things like that, I think, where you can short circuit a load of stuff that, you know, everyone else in business has 100 alignment meetings about, but actually just kind of making a thing and saying, you know, here's the thing, it could look like this. What do you think? And frequently I've heard of examples in that where, you know, stakeholders or C-suite, they see it and go, yeah, of course we want that. But if you try to make the argument for it sort of verbally or in a kind of presentation and say, you know, well, we've got this idea to do this thing, and, you know, whatever idea they have in their head is probably not your brilliant one. They're just going to come up with whatever they know it to be, or they think it is. And then they'll come up with all the risks for that. And then it's like, oh, no, we're not going to do that. Yeah. So, you know, the more you can make a tangible thing to show people sort of in advance of them actually approving it, you know, that has a massive impact. So that's kind of one thing. I know of another example where I think, you know, we are schooled in doing sort of extrapolating into the future. All right. And so a lot of that kind of systems thinking or kind of ecosystem thinking forms part of a certain group of designers. In particular. And I think that, you know, what's the problem behind the problem is a thing that we're very good at. And so I know of a situation where I have to be really careful. So it was a large hotel chain, and they were basically looking at making sort of smart, you know, the brief was, we want to do kind of smart door locks, right? So when people come to the hotel, they can kind of walk up to it with their phone and unlock the door. And this wasn't me, but I know the people who were working on this said, you know, this is the sort of height of Airbnb as well. You know, if you're looking at smart door locks, you're really just kind of looking at polishing your shoes whilst the freight train is coming down the track. You know, you're just not seeing what's going on. Let's instead completely rethink the hotel experience, because hotels have gone from, you know, oh, I'm staying at a hotel tonight to, oh, I'm staying at a hotel tonight. And, you know, that was a real problem. And I think designers are quite good at doing that reframe. And then the, if this, then that, right? If that's the case, then this is what it means. And this is how it all unfolds in terms. And again, it's that outside in view. It's that sort of human experience view of things. Those are kind of two things that designers, I think, really bring to the table. And it's just not leveraged enough. Because, and, you know, what that's doing is saying, you know, you think the opportunity is here, which is, you know, a tiny incremental advance over your competitors or just catching up. Whereas what we're actually saying is there's a whole load of stuff over here that's loads and loads of opportunities that no one's looking at. And that's what designers need to get used to talking about.
I think it's and that's probably tricky. I mean, it's so true. I mean, the whole, everything you said about, you know, storytelling, rapid prototyping are amazing skills, and they're just amazing values as well, because often, and I remember, you know, any company I go into, or even not just the tech heavy ones, but even the ones that have less tech in them, often go down a route of just building stuff. And it's like, hang on a second, you can build this on a paper. You can do X, Y, Z, like for pennies. You can basically step out, tap someone on the shoulder on the street and just get an opinion. You don't need to hire a massive research company or whoever else. And that seems to be quite something that can gain traction, but seems to be also hard for companies to build that into companies, to have this kind of really discovery part in there. Because often it feels, so the story I often get back on those ones is, you know, oh, it feels like, oh, we're just thinking, you know, it's design thinking, it's thinking. We're not doing anything. We're not building anything. It's like, we actually do that, you know, and the de-risking, I think, is a really good narrative on that that you mentioned earlier. But the other part with the, you know, look, but there's a bigger opportunity here. I mean, so I'm just going to bring that challenge back, and then we have time for maybe one more question, because we always have more questions than time. But very specific question, you know, if experience often seems complex, and if we say, oh, look at this bigger thing here, there might be a bigger opportunity here, it always sounds like, oh, that's more expensive, right? Or that takes longer. What's the answer to that then? Because in a way, that's often true. If you want to look at an area that you haven't looked at yet or no one else has looked at, you'll have to spend a bit more time there to dig down. At the same time, our argument would be, I don't know if it's the same for you, you know, these discovery things can be fairly quick, actually. It can be very fast-paced. Yeah. And then before you know it, you actually get a really fairly good answer to then decide to go further with it. But the whole complexity thing, how do you crack that narrative? Because I think that I find often is sort of held back to design. And when I see what some of the answers Tom Scott is getting when he's talking to CTOs and CIOs, it's like, oh yeah, design is often seen as, oh, it slows things down.
Yeah.
So what's the sort of counter?
Well, the classic... Well, my classic response to that is, we're slowing you down now in order to go fast in the right direction later. Because if we just run fast and sprint, you know, if you sprint in the wrong direction, you can very quickly end up in the wrong place, right? Always. And, you know, I mean, there's two bits about this. So there's that. That's the sort of nice answer. There's a kind of irritating thing as well, which is companies bleed so much time through awful pointless meetings and alignment meetings and stuff, precisely because of the stuff I was talking about before, because everyone's sort of feeling out, what is it we're doing and why are we doing this? We're not really sure. And let's have another meeting about that and so forth. Whereas you can actually, you know, cut to that quite quickly by creating an artifact or getting some data.
Yeah.
So, you know, yes, it does slow things down, but the desire for speed and velocity is just like any other deadline, it's often an illusion, right? There are very few, you know, if you're a startup and you've got a certain runway of money, then there's a reason for going pretty fast, right? Because you're trying to get a certain, you know, level of traction or your MVP or whatever it is before you run out of money. For like everyone else, not really. There's very few reasons why you should be going really fast. Right. Especially like taking the risk of going fast in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
So again, it comes back to that kind of risk thing, right?
Exactly. And even for startups, I'm sorry to interrupt. But, it's well documented in particular for startups to, you know, not sink it completely, because that's the only thing they have is the one idea that they're running with in the beginning. They say, you know, if startups are not able to pivot and check quickly if their product gets any traction, you know, they do the same thing. They actually probably test more than others, because for them it's even more substantial and more risky not to check, right? Because if they have one failure, the business is gone. If a company with five products has one product failing, they will likely survive it. So, yeah.
Exactly, I read, to answer the second bit of the question, I just read there's a really good book by Kate Tarling called The Service Organization. Mm-hmm. I can really recommend. It's very good.
Oh, yes, you mentioned that person.
And, you know, one of the things that a refrain quite often in the book is don't wait for permission. And so I think some of the stuff you just talked about is we can get some quick feedback on. We can sketch up something, you know, we can sketch up some stuff in an afternoon, and we can probably in the same day get some feedback on it, or in the next day get some feedback on it. We can video that, maybe that response. And, you know, what I'm always looking for for those kinds of things when you show it to leadership is the kind of face palm moment where you see a customer like trying to use their thing. And it's just like, oh, this is so irritating. I don't understand this. And yet it's, again, it's that outside in view of like, whereas everyone internally is like, oh, but this is really obvious. Now, it's very easy for them to just dismiss that one person, or that customer's not doing it right. They're stupid. They don't get it. But, you know, having some data, whether it is, I'm going to make the best attempt at kind of mapping out our ecosystem and all the sort of breaks in it, which is sort of Kate's thing. Or, you know, I'm going to sketch this thing up or make a kind of prototype, stuff that doesn't take you very long, and show it to some people, or then show that to kind of see, you know, to leadership. That's sort of a little bit sort of guerrilla tactics. I think it can be quite powerful, because then you have data, right? Then you've got the mix of, I mean, you might not have that much quant data, but you might have some facts and figures, but you definitely have then some qualitative data as well. And some stories to persuade people. And I think, you know, that is, there's a weird thing that when you're sort of doing that storytelling for business thing, which is, you know, you sort of need some kind of thesis or hypothesis that shakes people up a little bit, ideally. Mm. You know, if we don't do this, we're going to, you know, the business is going to go into the wall, or we're going to be disrupted, or, you know, here's this nice shiny new future that this is, you know, this is what it could be. And in that storytelling, you know, there's a bunch of questions that come up, which you should be able to answer. And you should be really thinking, you know, what's the person I'm presenting to going to be thinking about this? How do I know, you know, what data do you have? When you say this, this thing's a problem, how much of a problem is it? And you should have those facts and figures, right? Or we don't know, and nor do you. So let's go and do some research on this. And so you need the facts and figures, but you also need some stories. Like, you know, customer X was trying to do this and it all went wrong, and look at what a disaster it was. You know, look how terrible we were for their life or whatever it was. And I guarantee you it's the story that carries the weight. It's the thing that people carry away with them and remember. But it's the facts and figures that give people permission to believe in the story. If you just have the facts and figures, well, then you have the thing that climate change scientists have, which is, you know, we just need to give people more facts and more data. And that doesn't carry, you know, what makes people change their behavior is seeing a polar bear on a kind of melting kind of little piece of ice shelf and think, oh my God, you know, I need to do something about that. That you really need that combination of the two.
So to wrap things up, and I'm probably halfway contractually needed to throw one of those in. AI, there we go. I said
okay.
It. Have you seen anything that sort of, how would that impact people's thinking at this point, or anything else connected to it? Is it something people are already talking about or afraid of, or, you know, those kind of things, or talk about the potential of it?
So I wrote a thing quite a while ago, actually, about probably 2017, I think I wrote this, called Design in the Age of Synthetic Realities. You'll find it on, if you Google it, or on my website and stuff. And it was sort of, the core of it became one of the Fjord trends at the time, which I helped write, or wrote most of, but I sort of expanded it and talked about it quite a lot. You know, it's very nascent at the moment, obviously. One of the things that I thought was interesting back then was this platform called Runway ML, which has now become sort of like a video platform, sort of using AI. They pivoted into it. But what they originally did was they had created a sort of GUI wrapper around the different models. So basically you could say, I want to add this module, and it would download the build from GitHub, the repo from GitHub, and kind of run it in a little kind of Docker image and stuff. And it was the first time I saw, you know, being able to have fairly rapid feedback loop between, you know, interacting with it visually and, you know, say generating a bunch of different faces and go, oh, I want more like that. A bit like you do, you know, hue and brightness and stuff in Photoshop. And when that starts to happen, and it's kind of, like I said, it's very nascent. If you think really the prompts are command line stuff, we're still in the sort of command line. You know, ChatGPT wraps it up in a kind of chat interface, which I think is a clever bit of design, actually, bit of UX. But it's, you know, we're still in that, you know, we talk about prompt engineering, which I hate the phrase of, but it's still very nascent. And I think if you think back to the early days of Photoshop and so forth, or you know, 3D modeling, I remember doing my very first bit of 3D modeling was writing the coordinates of the you know, different nodes on the model, right? Not actually having a physical interface or, you know, a visual interface. So I think, you know, as that starts to accelerate and you get that feedback loop between people using it and then, you know, engineers seeing what people want and kind of reacting, lots of interesting stuff will happen. I think it will probably still be, I think it'll do one of two things. I think it'll for a lot of very mediocre stuff, it'll just be a cost saver, right? And this idea that I'm going to let the AI do all the kind of the difficult, you know, the drudgery stuff and leave me with time for the strategic thinking is not going to happen. Companies will take advantage of the fact that they can generate a load of stuff and not have to pay a load of people for it. And, across many, many industries, because a lot of people companies are quite happy with mediocrity. It's often better than what they already have. I think, it could be has the potential of being a really useful kind of brainstorming and a tool and a kind of, even if you use something like ChatGPT to say, here's a thing, give me kind of another 10 examples of this, or, how might I turn this inside out? Those kinds of things could be quite useful, sort of sparring partner. It also has the potential of probably sucking the life out of a lot of people's, the stuff they enjoy. An individual sphere, I've already read an example of a guy. He was a 3D concept artist for a games company. And, so his job was to make these model up like a robot and do a really nice render of it as a kind of still. It's like, oh, this is what this could be in the game. And you normally take him a couple of weeks to do that. And his boss was like, just do it in Mid Journey. And so he can, it takes him a couple of days to get really nice, get it. There's still some artistry there. It takes him a couple of days, but he just said, now I'm just a prompt monkey. Everything I used to love about this job has been taken away. I can completely see why my boss wants me to do that, because I can do, 10 times the amount in the same amount of time. But, I hate this now. Now, I think there's a certain level of aesthetics and understanding that you still need to have in order to make a really good, a prompted image. But, the danger is someone just goes, I don't want to do this. Or there's not really a livelihood in it. Or people will spend by day be doing their kind of prompt work, which earns them their money, a bit like musicians who write jingles. And then by night, they then do their sort of really creative work where they're actually doing it by hand and doing the kind of proper thing. And then there'll be this kind of special, here's this thing. And do you know what? We actually had someone do this for real rather than, an AI generator. And it'll become a sort of elite kind of...
It's interesting, isn't it? Like a lot of things, when you say anything from that's handmade or mass produced, it's probably the same kind of.
I think it's probably what's kind of
conversation.
Yeah,
and we'll need to see what it's get. Unfortunately, we're at time, so I could talk to you for hours, of course. Interested in very similar things, and so we can agree with each other a lot, can we? So that's always fun. But it was really nice talking to you, and thank you so much for all your insights and to be with me today.
Pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Wicked Podcast with co-host Marcus Kirsch and me, Troy Norcross.
Please subscribe on Podomatic, iTunes, or Spotify. You can find all relevant links in the show notes. Please tell us your thoughts in the comment section and let us know about any books for future episodes.
You can also get in touch with us directly on Twitter on @WickedAndBeyond or @Troy_Norcross. Also, learn more about the Wicked Company book and the Wicked Company project at wickedcompany.com.